On a Monday, it is a state capitol report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republicans who control the legislature's budget writing committee, Joint Finance, they added a $3.3 billion tax cut to the state budget as they wrapped up their revisions last week. The two-year spending plan now goes before the full Assembly and Senate. Here's Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu at a news conference Thursday.
We made incredible investments in the healthcare community just on Tuesday. And now we get to wrap this up with an amazing, amazing tax cut plan package that will benefit everybody in the state of Wisconsin.
What do you think of Republicans seeking to cut income and property taxes by more than $3 billion? Do you support more money back in the wallets of income earners and property owners? 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. So we heard the Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu just say there that this tax cut would benefit everybody in the state. Is that true?
Not everybody. Well, the property tax piece, if you're a homeowner or if you own property, yes. The income tax cut is actually going to help about 51% of people who file taxes in Wisconsin. It's geared toward people making between $25,000 and $225,000 or $250,000 in income. That's your Josie Gross income. And obviously, because of it's a wide range of pay, the lower you are on that end of that spectrum, the less the benefit is, right? The higher you are, the more of a benefit it is. And Democrats complained in the hearing last week that this benefits those who are better off unfairly. The Republican counter was, look, 2 years ago, they lowered the first two income tax brackets we have in Wisconsin. They said part of helping the economy strengthen, it's time to go to the third bracket. We have four overall. Go to that third bracket and adjust that down by almost a full percentage point because the people who are impacted here are the ones who actually pay taxes. Majority of taxes in Wisconsin are paid by a minority of the population. That's just the way it is because they earn more money. And so they're arguing this is a good way to help strengthen the economy.
Well, to that end, Sean on Twitter is asking, why is the tax relief so slanted toward those who are higher earners? What would you say there?
So because of range. So remember, in Wisconsin, the way it works, the tax brackets, let's just pick a number out of thin air. You make $250,000. The first chunk of your income is taxed at that lowest level, just like it is for anybody making that lowest level of the bracket. Then that next stratification of your income goes to the second bracket. Then the rest of it above 25 grand goes through that third stratification and that tax level. And so because of that, we're all getting taxed the same levels as we go up, but those guys go up higher, right, with what they're making. And so that higher income is being taxed at a lower level if it's signed by Governor Evers and it becomes law and it produces a bigger benefit for them.
What is the impact on businesses?
So, if you file your taxes as an individual rather than as a corporation, that you're going to be impacted by this tax cut. But also there is a proposed repeal of the personal property tax. Now, there's a caveat there. The personal property tax applies to things like if you're a restaurant, you own ovens, you purchase that oven, you begin to pay a property tax on your equipment. All right. But what they did was they put the money to backfill the lost local revenue into the budget, but they don't have the actual repeal in the budget. They have it in a separate bill. And it's kind of an interesting thing that they did. Now, remember, Governor Evers has the power to change bills with his partial veto authority if they spend money. By putting the actual repeal of the tax in a separate piece of legislation, the governor can't rework it with his partial veto pen because there's no spending there. But there's also no guarantee he'll sign that bill, which is working its way through the legislature as we speak. And then the money in the budget would go toward repealing that, backfilling the lost revenue from that tax. So I'm not sure how it's going to play out. The governor hasn't really weighed in yet. So that's going to be something interesting to watch. Does he, A, sign the budget in general, and B, would he sign this bill when he gets to his desk?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the state budget coming together with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics. You can join in. What do you think of Republicans and Democrats' proposals for state spending? What are your top priorities? What questions do you have about what is and isn't in the budget plan. 800-642-1234. JR, Democrats, they pushed against these tax cuts and they've urged more spending on schools and other government-funded services. Here is Milwaukee State Senator LaTanya Johnson at Joint Finance Committee Thursday.
It's blowing the biggest opportunity that we have, our one-in-a-lifetime opportunity, to invest in our state, in our kids, and in their precious futures.
So what else did you hear out of Democrats on this plan?
Well, they're concerned about a couple of things. One, there is a lot of federal money that Wisconsin's aligned to receive, Wisconsin schools are aligned to receive, through the latest COVID-19 relief package, the American Relief Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there's a lot, and I mean a lot of federal money coming between that one and the previous one, Democrats are arguing that we're not investing enough state dollars in education. And that, yes, there is a good deal of money these schools are going to get, but it comes with federal strings and how it can be used. It's supposed to kind of make up for losses incurred due to COVID. Well, that's not the same as getting state money from through the revenue formulas that you can spend on kind of a lot wider range of things. And so they're arguing that schools may end up getting a whole lot of money, but not being able to spend it where they need it, and then being kind of handcuffed as they deal with things like staff or what kids need. So that argument's going to come up in the course of this debate on the floor of the legislature probably next week.
There had been that alarm that Republicans' spending plan for schools could risk disqualifying our state from billions in federal aid. Has that been resolved?
Yes. What they did, though, was they made it part of a tax cut. So in Wisconsin, we have the things called revenue limits. They apply both where there's a per pupil limit for K-12, and there also is a revenue limit on tech colleges.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is each district gets money from the state based on a formula. And then whatever they get below that revenue limit, that spending limit, they can then raise property taxes to hit that amount. Republicans, with the additional state aid they put into schools and tech colleges, put it all in that formula, but kept the spending limit at the same amount. What that means is every dollar pretty much going in an additional state aid is going to drive down property taxes, not to increase billions of schools to spend money. It is going to help, again, if you're a homeowner. But these districts are not going to be spending more state money than they would be otherwise because of all this additional state aid coming in.
So when Governor Evers was running for governor, he vowed to increase school funding so that the state paid for 2/3 of public school costs. And Republicans touted their budget plan for finally achieving the state's goal of 2/3 funding for schools. Let's listen to Budget Committee Co-Chair Senator Howard Marklein of Spring Green on Thursday.
I've been in the legislature now for, 10, 11 years, and, it's something that we've dreamed about, we've worked hard on, and in this budget will get us across that goal line.
So get us across that goal line on 2/3, is that true?
Yes, so in the second year of the budget, they will be around 68% of K-12 education costs.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they get there because they keep the spending cap where it is, and drive in more state money. So they are picking up more because they're not going to be spending more in terms of state and property tax dollars that second year of the biennium.
Looking at our state's rainy day fund, the analysts have estimated that tax collections for the current fiscal year would be about $1.4 billion higher than previously estimated. So what does that mean for the rainy day fund?
Well, we have a lot of money that will go in that fund just as it is. So back in January, they are predicting an ending balance in this fiscal year, which is June 30th, of about $1.85 billion, and then $1 billion revenue growth over the next 2 years. They came back a couple weeks ago and said, actually, we're going to have $4.4 billion more in revenue than we thought.
Hmm.
I have never, ever, ever seen revenue numbers like that because the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is the nonpartisan budget arm legislature, it comes in every May or June of a budget year and gives a second look at what revenues look like. They use the word unprecedented for tax collections mm-hmm. in this memo. It was unlike anything I've ever seen. And what it means is even just with those revenue numbers alone, you're going to see the rainy day fund go to about $1.5 billion. Now, go back to a decade ago, and there's almost nothing in there. But what Republicans have done is they've also moved to send about $550 million in addition to that 3-day fund. The balance will be $2.1 billion. Now, we don't know what the final spending numbers will be in the budget until the governor signs it and everything. But that should be about 10% of revenues in one of the two fiscal years coming up. That is such a high amount. There's an automatic trigger under state law that if we have excess revenues beyond what we expected, half goes into the rainy day fund. Yeah. Until we hit 5% of state expenditures. We are going to eclipse that trigger, and that will no longer have the excess revenue going there. People didn't anticipate that a decade ago. I'll tell you that much. This is
unprecedented. Why are tax revenue estimates so off? Is this normal, calling on your institutional memory of the Legislative Fiscal Bureau?
No, and the only thing that's changed since January when they did the last revenue estimates are two things. One, the American Rescue Plan Act was signed by President Biden. And two, things have gotten directly better with COVID, right? Think back to January where we thought we might be with vaccinations, mm-hmm. where we might be with caseloads. We are seeing dramatic improvements on all those fronts. Things are opening up. People are spending money, right? Because they've been cooped up for a year, year and a half, and they want to get out there and do stuff. So Fiscal Bureau is seeing the signs of that economic recovery, and the American Rescue Plan Act is pumping so much money into the system. I mean, we're talking tons and tons of money that is just juicing everything. It's just giving a supercharge to the economy. Now, the warning is this is, we think, a one-time shot, right? You're talking a big stimulus package. What happens once that stimulus effect wears away? 2 years from now, will we be in the same situation, or might we go back to where we expected to be, you know, pre-ARPA? We don't know. It's a long way away, and I'm not an economist. I'm not going to predict revenues 2.5 years down the road. But it is a warning sign for us that we may have to kind of be braced for, okay, that big shot's gone away. Now what? Now what are we going to do?
WizPolitics editor J.R. Ross giving us analysis on the budget writing process as the legislature's Joint Finance Committee has wrapped up its work. What questions do you have about what is and isn't in the budget? What questions do you have about the budgeting process for a veteran reporter of Wisconsin State House? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with J.R. Ross on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is projected to take in billions of dollars more in tax revenue than previously expected over several fiscal years. Republicans have pushed for tax cuts, as we've been talking about, and that's what we saw as the legislature's 16-member budget writing committee wrapped up its work last week. It runs counter to Governor Evers' push for spending much more on schools. What should Wisconsin do with its revenue windfall? How do you return excess revenue in a way that makes our state more economically competitive in the process and in the future? 800-642-1234. We have WisPolitics editor J.R. Ross with us. So, J.R., earlier last week, the budget committee, they took up broadband expansion. Democrats and Republicans both want more state funding for broadband. How much do they disagree on the amounts? JR, are you there? I think we're having some difficulty hearing JR Ross as we talk about the budget writing process. JR, can you hear us? I think we've lost JR Ross, but you can join in on the budget. What questions do you have about the budget? What do you see that should be done about the revenue windfall? Would you like to see a tax cut, or should the state fund more services? You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we get J.R. Ross of WisPolitics back on the line, perhaps shaky internet as we were going to talk about broadband, the irony there. What do you see out of the budget and the two-year spending plan? What are your top priorities? Do you think it should go to schools, or what about a tax cut? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. JR, do we have you back?
Yes, I am.
All right. So broadband, I don't know if you heard the question about the legislature's, budget writing committee looking at broadband expansion. What do you see there?
Well, interestingly, Governor Evers wanted to do about $200 million broadband investment with state dollars, state tax dollars, period. The committee approved $129 million, but of that, $125 million is borrowing. Hmm. Now, it's an interesting approach that you're talking about a rapidly evolving technology that you may take 20 years to pay off the cost of the bonds for the technology, right? So we're not quite sure why that move was made. The best guesses we have are a couple things. One, that maintenance effort we talked about to qualify for the federal funding, the education funding, you have to have your share of state tax dollars going to education and higher ed be the same in these coming fiscal years compared to like this baseline. The more general purpose revenue you spend on something like broadband, the more you have to spend on schools and higher ed to qualify for that federal money. The less GPR, the lower the bar. So maybe they're trying to save general purpose revenue there. Number two, there are a number of initiatives already underway to expand broadband. Charter Communications announced a $600 million effort just in March. The governor's announced $100 million from the federal ARPA funds. So that's north of $700 million. We don't really know what it would take to cover the entire state with broadband.
Mm-hmm.
There's a memo from the Fiscal Bureau that said the cost could be between $700 million and $1.4 billion. It's a huge range. So there's a question of, do we need to put that much more in right now? Should we maybe see what's going on in the private sector and these other efforts and let them play out first and then tap that spending or that borrowing if needed?
Yeah, and you mentioned the American Rescue Plan there and what is coming from the federal government and its piece for broadband and supporting expansion there. You know, do you see that as a significant influence?
Yeah, and, you know, the interesting thing is the federal money doesn't go as far as state money in terms of paying for expansion. The federal money comes with strings. One of those strings is you have to have an upload speed of 100 megabytes per second and a download speed of the same level. With the state money, you can do 25 and 3. That's a much lower bar. Mm. It's much cheaper, therefore, from the technology to other places. And one of the things is in Wisconsin, it's not necessarily the reach. I think we're at like 94% of the state has access. That last 6% is really rural and a really hard build out, right? It's always the last mile. It's
that last mile.
But it's being able to afford it. I think we're like in the upper 60, 68% roughly for people who have it. So people aren't subscribing to it. Why? Can they not afford it? Is it not feasible? You know, all these questions about maybe that's more of an issue for us than it is the infrastructure. Although if you are in that 6% of the state doesn't have it, you definitely want to have access to it.
Let's bring in John and Boaz. John, what are your thoughts on the budget?
Invest in the future. Fund improving tourism. Because Wisconsin is number one in the ratio of tourism to industry in our nation. We have the most beautiful state in the north, central, you know, United States. Let's talk about the trail system that we have for hiking and biking. Well, how about side-by-sides and ATVs and snowmobiles? That brings in huge tourism revenue.
John, thanks. We're short on time, and I want to get JR to respond there. What does the spending plan do for tourism?
They are investing in tourism, trying to increase the amount of spending there. And it's like what the rest of the budget Republicans did. They basically took current law and sprinkled in a little bit more money here and there, the places that they thought were priorities, without going to where Governor Evers wanted to on a lot of his priorities.
So looking back at the committee's work since Governor Evers introduced his budget proposal, what were your biggest surprises?
Well, the revenue that came out. I mean, I've never seen it. I'll never see anything like that ever again, I'm going to guess. So that was probably the biggest thing, just the amount of money they were able to spend or put toward tax cuts because of ARPA. That wasn't really something we were seeing. What I'm watching now is, what does Governor Evers do? I think we talked before that he had a couple of red lines, right? One of them was expanding Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that. One of them was funding education. Well, they did that, but not the way he wanted, right? They funded education to drive down property taxes, but they also hit that maintenance of effort requirement. So when they send this budget to him, what will Governor Evers do? And I've been asking people about this constantly for the last couple of weeks. And the point they've made to me is a couple of things. One, If Evers doesn't sign this budget, he vetoes the entire thing, Republicans are not going to do another one. They've told us that already. So he's in a box right now. If he doesn't sign this, he's at fault for not reaching the maintenance of effort. And he just makes the $3.3 or $4 billion tax cut. That's a tough thing to do just off from reelection.
JR, always good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.
You too. JR Ross is editor of WisPolitics. Just ahead, dozens of Wisconsin businesses have voiced opposition to a series of bills aimed at election reform. We talk about it with a Milwaukee private equity fund manager. We'll be back for more of the State Capitol Report after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of business leaders around the state signed on to a letter this month urging lawmakers not to advance legislation that limits voting access or creates additional barriers to casting a ballot. The letter was coordinated by the Wisconsin Voting Rights Coalition. What are your thoughts on voting bills backed by Republicans in Wisconsin and across the nation? Business owners, how would stricter voting access affect your business or ability to recruit employees? Join in 800-642-1234. Corey Nettles is founder and managing director of Generation Growth Capital, a private equity firm based in Milwaukee that aims to boost small business growth. Corey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate being here.
Well, good morning. Explain the essence of what this letter to lawmakers was about.
Well, we're concerned as business leaders about any additional restrictions on the right to vote in Wisconsin. I think this is bad for the state. I think it's bad for the economy, and I think it's bad for democracy. And we thought it important that a broad group and coalition of business leaders stand up and say that publicly to our lawmakers as they are advancing these various bills. So we thought it important, you know, as business leaders, as people who hire people, who have large and large and diverse employee bases, that we speak up in support of voter rights in Wisconsin.
Yeah, what are conversations like with other business leaders, with your peers, and how this relates and connects to legislation about voting?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. There's as you might expect, a wide range of views on this. There are some business leaders who do not think that it is their place to speak up at all. There are others who have, you know, political views across the spectrum, some of whom support restrictions like this. But in my experience, and it's not scientific, you know, most business leaders are opposed to these kinds of measures. And some of us have also been willing to speak out in opposition. But there's a wide range of views on this, as you might expect. And some are trying to figure out how do they enter as business leaders into the public policy and political fray. This is very fraught. You know, as business owners, we have broad stakeholders from investors and shareholders to employees. So a lot of business owners are struggling with whether to speak up at all, and if so, how. So it's been an interesting sort of conversation. Those of us who, this isn't fair, but you know, a group of us who spoke up, we spoke up on behalf of the economy and on behalf of our businesses. And we think that these legislative efforts are not in the best interest of our business and not in the best interest of our democracy.
Corey Nettles, specifically, what measures in particular are you opposed to? What stands out?
Yeah, you know, for me, that's a great question. What I've said is I'm against the whole package, because I think all of them are unnecessary infractions on the right to vote. I think anything in a democracy that makes it more difficult for people to vote is a bad idea. So that's been number one. Number two, I'm a Lawrence University proud alum. I was a government political science major, and my American politics professor, you know, may rest in peace, Larry Longley. Professor Longley taught me as a government student that anytime there's legislation, the question is always, number one, what problem are we trying to solve? And number two, why does it need solving now? So when I look at these legislative proposals, the question for me is always, what problem are we trying to solve? The folks who are pushing these often will lead with fraud, voter fraud.
Improving election security, voter confidence, you know, election integrity.
Absolutely. And every study that's been done for decades has consistently demonstrated that there is no significant voter fraud that exists in our country. Are there one or two cases, you know, and I read some anecdotes over the weekend of people who vote twice, you know, recently released felons who don't understand what their voting status is, who vote inadvertently. Yes, there are some anecdotes, but nothing that rises to the level of statistical significance. So I can't see what problem, what legitimate policy problem we're trying to solve. And as I said to some business leaders over the weekend who are tepid about this or reticent or hesitant, what this really is to me is a pretty clear example to reshape the electorate in a partisan way. And you know, I'm a fairly apolitical person. I'm not a party person. I don't believe in party politics. I don't join parties. I vote for individual candidates based on individual issues. But it's been clear that the Republican Party has said they cannot win on the battlefield of ideas. And the way that they win is to reshape or redefine the electorate, and specifically to limit who gets to vote. And in a democracy, we shouldn't do anything at all to support that. We need to push back against that, whether it's done by either side. There's gerrymandering that happens on both sides, for example. That's all bad for a democracy. So I'm sorry for the long-winded answer, but there's no one bill. I'm against the package because I don't think that there's a legitimate policy problem that needs solving. And I don't think a democratic society ought to be looking at ways to limit the franchise.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Corey Nettles, Managing Director of Generation Growth Capital in Milwaukee, as we discuss an open letter to lawmakers from some in Wisconsin's business community criticizing legislation that would put up additional barriers to casting a ballot. Getting your thoughts about it as well at 800-642-1234. Jeff is joining us from Delafield. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is obviously voting is a very sacred, critical piece of our democracy, and we have to protect that against fraud. And I understand what the last speaker mentioned, saying there's no evidence of fraud. Well, fraud is, what is fraud? Fraud is what society defines it as. And is mail-in voting fraud? No. And a lot of people have done it for years. But my understanding is that there's laws, there's supposed to be laws that say you can't campaign within X number of feet or whatever it is of a polling station. Well, when you're going door to door with absentee ballots, you're obviously campaigning. You're working for one side or the other. And that polling station becomes your front doorstep. So how is that not campaigning at a polling station? So is that fraud? Well, by one rule, I think it is. So I guess I don't understand what's wrong with the protection saying that, you know, it should be a little bit hard to vote by maybe making you go to a polling station, maybe voting absentee for a legitimate reason. But again, we need to protect the process. And yes, we have to do that so that we're not restricting the right to vote. But again, we need to protect the process. And
Jeff,
that's my comment.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you. Jeff, looking at the nuance there, your reaction, Corey.
Yeah, I guess several things. Number one, the laws on campaigning near a polling station are specifically on election day within certain given hours. Being out canvassing door to door to encourage people to vote, including by absentee, and to have a residence that's across the street from a polling station, which are very often inside of elementary schools or church basements, that's not fraud and that's not against the law. So that specific example isn't the right one, number one. You know, number two, we have very serious voter protection laws in place. And if anyone, a candidate campaigning on election day at a polling station is a clear violation of election laws, invariably somebody does it, And that should be appropriately sanctioned. And we have existing laws that make clear that you can't do that. And whether it's that or whether it's people who aren't eligible to vote, who vote inadvertently or who vote intentionally, sometimes twice in two different jurisdictions where they move, there's laws on the books now to protect the integrity of the process in that regard. And those laws should be enforced. But most importantly, you know, Jeff said something that I guess I fundamentally disagree with, and I think this is at the heart of this debate. He said it should be a little hard to vote. I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I think voting should be made easier in our country, not harder in our country. You know, in my business life, I spend several days a week traveling. And invariably, I have to be out of town on business, supporting my family on election day. Sometimes I know in advance that on Tuesday, November, whatever, I got to be in New York or in D.C. or wherever I have to be. Well, I should have the option to vote absentee because I can't be at election. I can't vote in person on election day. I think in our democracy, there's ways to protect the franchise, but to allow flexibility. There are people who work, who can't get off of work during the 8 to 5 p.m. or the 8 to 8 p.m. that polling stations are available. Why should elections be limited to just that one day? I support digital voting. So my broader point, and where Jeff and I fundamentally disagree, is I think that we need to protect the franchise and the integrity of the franchise, but we need to make it easier for people to vote and not make it hard to vote.
We have a business owner, Jody from Downing, on the line. Jody, your thoughts?
Hi. Yeah, I'm a small business owner, and I haven't really thought about how these laws affect my small business. But I'd be happy to sign on to this letter. I totally agree. To me, this is a complete waste of time. It's happening all over the country, and it's total voter suppression. I've done some watching at the recounts in our county, and I have complete confidence in the system here. I've helped do voter registration, and I know it can be really cumbersome with just the way it is right now with all, you know, all the documents that people need to be able to be registered. And it's a right that everybody should be able to have, and we should make it easier for people to vote. My son lives in Oregon where he can vote by mail, and I think everybody should be able to do that. How easy and how inclusive that is for everyone. Mm. So that's what I have to say.
Jody, thanks. Corey.
Totally agree with Jody's sentiments. Oregon's a great example. You know, people ought to be allowed to vote by mail. People ought to be allowed to vote, you know, absentee if that's their preference. I take pride in going to the election poll and voting in person and getting my little I voted sticker. That's great, but not everybody has the ability to do that. We have people who are homebound. You know, I have a grandmother who doesn't drive and who has limited mobility. Schlepping her out on that Tuesday to the polls and putting her through all of that so she can exercise her right to vote is an unnecessary, restriction or limitation on someone who spent her whole life working and doing everything she can to uphold the values of a free and open society and a democracy. So we ought to make it more easy for people, particularly senior people, disabled people, but folks who got to work. So, and there's no reason that we can't do this while at the same time protecting the integrity of the franchise. Other states have done it. Other countries have done it. We can do this. We live in a digital age. There's digital encryption. There are all kinds of things that we can do to protect the franchise. But our value and our goal should be to make it easier. We're the most revered democracy in the world. If we're really going to be that beacon of democracy, then we need to show the rest of the world how you can do this, how you can allow people to vote and exercise their franchise while at the same time maintaining election security.
Corey Nettles is managing director of a private equity firm in Milwaukee. We're talking about legislation that creates restrictions on voting in Wisconsin and what it would mean to businesses and industry. Are you concerned about voter fraud and election security and feel such legislation is vital to election integrity? Are you concerned about the perception and image of Wisconsin if voting restrictions advance through the legislature? What does it say about our state? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Corey Nettles on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Corey Nettles, managing director of a Milwaukee-based private equity firm which aims to build up small businesses. He signed onto a letter this month alongside more than 60 business leaders sent to lawmakers opposing bills that would limit drop boxes, create additional paperwork for absentee voting, and require voters with disabilities to provide copies of their IDs in more cases. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234, and Corey Nettles is with us for about 10 more minutes. Corey, help us connect the dots. You run an investment fund in Milwaukee that focuses on helping the small businesses, medium businesses grow. How do you think changes in Wisconsin elections would correlate, would affect Milwaukee businesses?
Yeah, I don't think it's just Milwaukee businesses. I think it's the state of Wisconsin businesses. So stepping back a step, you know, back in 2003 to 2005, I was the Commerce Secretary for the state of Wisconsin. It was a great honor that I had bestowed upon me by then Governor Jim Doyle. And one of the things I learned is that Wisconsin has a brain drain problem. Too many of our educated high school graduates and college graduates were leaving Wisconsin and going to other places, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, et cetera. So the real question became, how can we retain and attract more people here in Wisconsin? Part of the concern that I have about this group of bills as it relates to our Wisconsin economy is that we begin to create a culture and a climate where the very workers that we need to retain and attract and say, if this is the values of this state, if this is the culture and the climate of this state, I don't want to live here. I want to live in a free and open society that values participation in our democracy, that values people of all different sort of backgrounds. So I'm very concerned that this will affect negatively our ability to retain and attract talent in a state whose population is flat to declining. We can't afford to put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage relative to other states by doing things that create a culture and a climate that make the next generation of workers, these young, you know, up and coming stars say, you know what, I don't want to live in Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin is a purple state and I'm proud of that. It's neither blue nor red, it's purple. But if we create a culture and a climate where people feel like their rights are being suppressed or the rights of others are being suppressed, then that talent is very mobile and they can land someplace else, you know, where they feel like they can participate more freely in society. So I think this is a broader contextual problem for our state and could be a real impediment to our ability to retain and attract talent.
Let's go to Bruce now in Green Bay. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I was calling, I don't understand, if the legislature really wants to democracy, they should make it a felony to gerrymander. And they should make it a felony to purge voters without a real justifiable reason. I just feel that what's going on should be illegal, what they're trying to do. It's obvious they've run out of ideas and they can't get people to vote for them.
So Bruce is really echoing there, Corey, what you're saying. You know, and Governor Evers hasn't said whether he would sign Republicans' election bills. So why do you think it's important to speak out at this stage?
Well, because I think our democracy is at stake. And I don't say that, you know, for hyperbole. You know, if you start placing restrictions and limitations on who can vote, you know, this is like Back to the Future, you know, 75 years ago. So think about, you know, civil rights movements and voter rights movements that came out of the southern part of our country back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, culminating in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That fundamental fight was about who got to vote in this country. This is sort of retrograde. And we as a society, as a country, can't be in this place where we're saying we want fewer people to vote and not more people to vote. So I think our friend from Green Bay got it right. You know, it's obvious what the intention is here. And we as a not just business leaders, but as a democratic society, as citizens, we all have to push back on this. You know, to be clear, you know, I'm a political science major. I believe in democracy, you know, to my core. I want there to be two or more healthy, strong parties battling it out on the battlefield of ideas. You know, that's what democracy is all about. It's not about limiting who can vote. So we all need to be calling our legislators. We need to be pushing back on this. We need to be saying no. We need to not fall for the obvious sham that this is in a very hyper-partisan environment. We all have to push back and protect democracy and the franchise for all of our citizens. We all have that obligation. I'm glad that some business leaders are stepping up to do it, but all of us have to do it.
Corey Nettles leads a Milwaukee-based private equity fund. We're discussing a letter sent to lawmakers from dozens of Wisconsin business leaders. It criticizes legislation, as we've been talking about, that creates additional red tape for voting. And getting your thoughts along the way, Marcy is with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Marcy. What is on your mind?
Hi there. Yeah, I think it's absolutely, totally absurd to consider that anything that is strengthening our voter integrity or tries to ensure it is some sort of fraud or suppressing voter rights. Voting is extremely easy. You go in, you show an ID, a mark, an X. There's nothing difficult about this. And to say that it's somehow suppressing, you are pushing a falsehood right there. That's nonsense. If my vote isn't assured by integrity, I have no vote either. So you're suppressing me. So that's my comments.
Corey.
Well, you know, facts are stubborn things. And you're entitled to your opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. What the facts are, is that there's no significant evidence of the integrity of the vote in our state, in our country, ever being compromised. There's no evidence of that. Are there one or two cases that happen somewhere in the country? Absolutely. Are there some people who intentionally commit voter fraud? Absolutely. It is a statistically insignificant number. So the question is, back to Professor Larry Longley, what is the problem we're trying to solve? There is no need to strengthen voter integrity in our state. We have strong laws on the books now. We have prosecutors all across our state who every cycle prosecute people who violate those laws, and I want them to. I want Marcy's vote to be protected. I want my vote to be protected. I want my grandmother's vote to be protected. But all of those protections exist today. What we're doing now goes beyond strengthening the vote. It goes to suppressing the vote of people. And that's really what this is about. We have to ask ourselves, why all across the country are these bills only being pushed by Republicans? If there was a problem with the franchise, I would hope that Republicans and Democrats would come together in a bipartisan way to fix that. These bills are not bipartisan because there's no bipartisan Democratic problem to solve. It's very clear what Republicans across the country are trying to do. It pains me and breaks my heart that they're trying to do it as a person who believes in democracy. But there is no problem in the need to strengthen our democracy and protect Marcy and other people's franchise. So, you know, I would say go focus on the facts. Go to your Google machine, look at voter fraud, Google it, and you'll find out factually that it's statistically insignificant in our country and certainly here in Wisconsin.
Corey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Corey Nettles is founder and managing director of Generation Growth Capital in Milwaukee. Just ahead, we take a look at how herbal remedies are used to treat pain and boost your immune system. Do you use herbs for your ailments? What helps? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.